Hey guys, welcome back to Making a Dietitian. I am your host, Cassie, and today we are going to be covering my personal favorite topic, which is bariatric surgery. So yeah, let's just get started. So bariatric surgery is basically a weight loss surgery that is used for patients who are in class 3 obesity. It has been determined to be the best weight loss procedure or weight loss kind of like tool for anyone who is in class 3 obesity, because it is very hard to lose weight. So that being said, there are requirements for bariatric surgery. The qualifications include having a BMI over or equal to or greater than 40, or more than 100 pounds overweight. Or you could have a BMI greater than equal to 35 and at least one or more obesity related comorbidities. This could be type 2 diabetes, heart disease, sleep apnea, hypertension, dyslipidemia, GERD, any of those things. And then another qualification would be the inability to achieve weight loss sustained for a period of time with prior weight loss efforts. So that would just mean, like, if you've been trying throughout the years and say you've been going on numerous diets or you've been in a caloric deficit and you still just haven't been able to retain that weight loss, then that's whenever we're going to look in and see, oh, okay, bariatric surgery would probably be best for this patient because it seems as though no other route is working. So when it comes to bariatric surgery, there's not just like a one type fits all. There are actually 5 different types of bariatric surgery that can be performed, and they're all slightly different with their own risks and advantages. So a sleeve gastrectomy is performed by removing 80% of the stomach with surgical staplers. So this new stomach holds much less food than previously, so you're going to be consuming less calories during mealtimes. Also, the portion of the stomach that is removed produces ghrelin, the hunger hormone, so patients have decreased hunger, increased fullness, and better control of their weight and blood sugar. Since it is a surgical procedure, you are actually like removing part of the stomach with that. So it is like a surgery. It's a lot more invasive than other ones. Next, we have the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. This is the one personally that we have covered most in the dietetics courses. You'll probably get questions on this whenever it comes to your courses and everything, so just kind of keep that in mind. This is going to be characterized by the creation of a smaller stomach pouch by dividing the stomach into 2 parts. So the smaller upper portion of the stomach is going to be reattached to a portion of the small intestine that has also been divided into 2 portions. So this new stomach is going to hold very little food, much like that of the gastric sleeve. The bottom, larger portion of the stomach is no longer going to hold food because it's not attached to the top portion, but then it's going to be attached to the beginning of the small intestine. And the beginning of the small intestine is then attached back to the other portion of the small intestine where gastric and pancreatic juices will mix with food that is consumed. That sounds really confusing to say it out loud, but when you see a diagram of it, it makes a lot more sense. So basically, you're just cutting in half both your stomach and not in half, but like you're cutting into 2 portions, your stomach and your small intestines, and you're reattaching those so that you're still getting like the juices, but you still have a smaller stomach up here. I really recommend that you look up a diagram just because it'll be a little bit easier to kind of visualize that way. So next, after that, we have an adjustable gastric band. This is a device made of silicone that is placed around the top part of the stomach, and it creates a small pouch above the band. The feeling of fullness depends on the size of the opening between the pouch and the rest of the stomach, and the adjustable gastric band has the most modest effect of any of the other ones. So really, it's not going to have a huge effect on your metabolism, or if you're suffering from type 2 diabetes, it's really not going to have much of an effect on that either. This one isn't going to be as invasive because you're not cutting out or making like surgery or anything like that. It's removable if needed, so it's really not going to be as serious, and it's obviously reversible. So the next two are ones that we didn't really cover much in class, but I do feel as though they're worth mentioning because they are surgeries. So we have a biliopancreatic diversion with a duodenal switch. So this follows the creation of a sleeve-like stomach, but the first section of the small intestine is separated from the stomach. The next section of the small intestine is brought up and connected to the outlet of the stomach so that the new food now goes through the stomach into the latter part of the small intestine. The smaller stomach restricts the amount of food a patient may consume at one time, and then the resection of the small intestine decreases the absorption of calories and nutrients. This particular form of surgery decreases hunger hormones, increases fullness, and improves blood sugar control, being considered the most effective approved metabolic operation for type 2 diabetes. Like I said, we haven't talked much about that one, so meh. But I will say that depending on where you have your stomach resected in your small to your small intestine is going to affect the absorption of a lot of your micronutrients, especially your like vitamin B's. That's really important. So you just want to kind of keep that in mind. But again, if you're suffering from type 2 diabetes, this might be something that you really want to consider. So the last type of bariatric surgery is going to be a single anastomosis duodeno-ileal bypass with sleeve gastrectomy, which is absolutely horrible to say. This is the most recent procedure to be endorsed by, where did I get this from? The American Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery. So this is the most recent procedure to be endorsed by them. It is simpler and less time consuming compared to the one I did just discuss. The operation begins the same way as a sleeve gastrectomy. The first part of the small intestine is then divided after the stomach, and a loop of the intestine is measured several feet from its end and connected to the stomach. The surgery works by allowing food to go from the stomach pouch to the latter portion of the small intestine, where it mixes with digestive juices from the first part, allowing for vitamin and mineral absorption. So that's where we're going to have that vitamin and mineral absorption that we may be missing whenever we are considering doing the biliopancreatic diversion with a duodenal switch. So that's kind of where the difference is between those two. Like I said, really the ones that we cover most are going to be those first three. So a sleeve gastrectomy, a Roux-en-Y, and the adjustable gastric band. You may come across those other two. I just don't feel as though they're as common. So, you know, kind of take that as is. So, the expected benefits and risks of bariatric surgery. For most individuals, I believe that the benefits are going to outweigh the risks. So benefits are going to include an average 3-year weight loss of 62% of excess weight. More than 90% of patients experience improvements related to asthma, hypertension, type 2 diabetes, GERD, and sleep apnea. Which a lot of people who suffer from obesity are going to have those comorbidities. So we really want to keep that in mind whenever it comes to relieving other symptoms other than just weight. Along with the benefits, there's a rate of less than 5% concerning serious complications. Also, for people who are classified as obesity class 3, bariatric surgery is considered the best option when it comes to weight loss. So overall, the relatively low risk and complications of the procedure outweigh the risks of not having surgery, just when you put it into perspective. And that's not going to be true for everyone. Everyone is going to kind of have their own opinions, and that's totally fine. Just coming from a stance of being a dietitian, I love bariatric surgery. It's really what I'm super passionate about, and I really hope to have a career in it someday. So for me, I really do want to work with people and help them understand that this procedure, you can choose from 5 different ones. You can obviously choose whichever one is best for you. So there's no pressure for me as a dietitian for someone to get bariatric surgery, but I would offer it as an option because it can change people's lives. I mean, there are testimonies of people who have gone through bariatric surgery and they say it's changed their lives. So just saying, it sounds pretty cool. Obviously there are risks associated with bariatric surgery. Varying weight loss, obviously it's going to have to do with how well you are following the regimen after, before and after your surgery. Also which surgery you get. There's no guarantee of a successful surgery. Again, like I just said, it completely depends on a person's ability to follow that recommended diet afterward. Some procedures are not reversible, which is scary for some people. So if that's a concern, probably go with the gastric band. But again, also know that if you go with the gastric band, your results aren't going to be as noticeable as some of the other surgeries. Extreme weight loss may result in cosmetic issues. This would just include like loose skin. A lot of times, a lot of people who have had bariatric surgery will notice that they do have loose skin once losing that weight. And of course, you don't have to get that fixed. There's no pressure to have that extra skin removed, but a lot of people choose to, and that's completely fine as well. So that's always something that you have to think of. There's also possible complications, including ulcers, malnutrition, rehospitalization, and death in serious cases. But honestly, I think those are going to come with not following the recommended diet that we have. And I do lay that out further along in this episode. So whenever it comes to choosing the best bariatric surgeon in your area, not every city is going to offer bariatric surgery. Totally fine. You really just need to go with a surgeon that you're comfortable with and who has experience necessary for your desired surgery. You don't want to go to someone who's like, oh, I specialize in a gastric band, and you're sitting here wanting to do a Roux-en-Y. One, because they may try and change your mind. And you really need to stick with what you are comfortable with. Also, you want someone who is confident in what they're doing, because a lot of, like, these are very serious surgeries. So also, they may only specialize in the one that's not the most affected or best suited for you. So you really want to do your research on which type of surgery is the best option for what you have going on in your life, what you're willing to do as far as the diet goes and life changes, and think about like, oh, if I have type 2 diabetes, oh, if I have heart disease, which one of these is going to be the best for me? And schedule consultations with numerous surgeons. Talk to them about what you're wanting. Talk to them about their experience. Ask questions. Don't be afraid to tell them exactly what you want. So moving on, there is a pre-surgical nutrition evaluation. So it's designed to help patients recognize the need for positive lifestyle changes and assist them in developing a plan to implement those changes. A lot of times, I remember I've sat in on a few of these consultations, and you're going to have both individual ones and you're going to have group sessions. So when the ones I sat in on, I did numerous group sessions. So it's where people had been coming to one-on-one consultations for a while with a dietitian, and then they would host, I think it was like maybe a few times a month, people who are planning on getting the surgeries would come in, and we would sit down and hand out a packet about what to expect, what's going to be going on, and say, okay, these are changes we want to see you do right now, and then these are the changes that you're going to have to do after the surgery, so you might as well start making them now. It was really beneficial because it was kind of like a focus group. We had people sit around and talk, and then people could ask questions that other people might have. It was just really nice. It was also kind of like a support group because this is a surgery. It can be kind of scary. So you do want to have all those people around you that you know are going through the same thing as you. And I personally really loved it. The environment was always so nice, and everyone was so supportive of each other. And that's just something that I really enjoyed. But obviously, whenever we're doing these like nutrition evaluations and measurements, you're going to be doing that in more of a one-on-one setting because that is private information. So the preoperative nutritional evaluation is going to include a review of anthropometrical data, weight history, past diet history, medical history, available lab values, psychological history, social history, substance abuse history, nutrition focused physical findings, dietary intake, physical activity, and psychosocial factors that affect weight loss. We really just want to know all of these because it's just as much mental, or it's even more mental when concerning bariatric surgery than it is physical, because you have to have the ability to stick to a very strict diet after. And you have to have people in your life who are supporting you, because it's so hard to go through this by yourself. Substance abuse history, we really need to know that, because you're not going to be able to drink alcohol because it has no nutritional value and your stomach can only hold so much. So if you're filling up on alcohol, you're not getting any nutrients. So you're probably going to have malnutrition if you continue on that, doing that. So, and then all those other things are also going to affect. So we really need to know all of that. The most common areas dietitians will need to counsel patients on include portion control, macro and micronutrient compositions, skipping meals, and physical activity, for obvious reasons. And I go more in depth as to what a typical diet is going to look like after this. So, then we go into, should you lose weight before the surgery? Many bariatric surgeons are going to require some form of weight loss prior to bariatric surgery, and this is going to be to ensure that a patient is able to maintain the diet necessary post-op. So whether they say it or not, I think in our case, in the sessions I have sat in on, we did recommend that you lose weight because you wanted to get down to a certain weight before the surgery so you're not as at risk. And then it was also to show that, yes, I can follow that diet. So what is the nutritional impact of bariatric surgery? It's pretty big, honestly. So patients who have undergone bariatric surgery are forced to decrease the quantity and increase the quality of foods eaten. And this is something that is very difficult. So the results of a study conducted by Carlson, Canerva, and Larson suggest that a diet that includes less than 35% of total energy from fat, more than 45% of total energy from carbs, and about 20% of total energy from protein is favorable in enhancing post-surgery weight loss and maintenance. That clearly follows our recommendations as dietitians already for macronutrient distribution. If you go back to the macronutrient episode, you can listen to what that distribution range is. So that already follows it. It's not like we're making any crazy changes. Protein malnutrition can become a concern, as a poor protein digestion absorption is secondary to pancreatic and biliary functions. So to combat this, patients should aim to consume between 60 to 120 grams of protein per day before surgery, and then increase by 30% following surgery. That sounds crazy and it sounds like a lot, but we do take steps to ensure that you are receiving enough protein in your diet, and you'll see that later on whenever I go through kind of like the post-op recommendations. So because patients are only able to consume a fraction of what they're used to, they're forced to make better dietary decisions and cut out foods that are sugary or high in fat. On the other hand, micronutrient deficiencies are common in those who undergo bariatric surgery, causing anemia, abnormal bone metabolism, and other vitamin and mineral deficiencies. Anemia occurs as a result of vitamin B12 and folate deficiencies, as less of the intrinsic factor may be available to assist in the absorption of the vitamin, or the resection site may not be able to absorb the vitamins as easily. And that's kind of what I talked about earlier with the B vitamins. whenever you resect it to the duodenum or duodenum, however you pronounce it, you're skipping that whole section that will typically absorb your B vitamins. Bariatric surgery could impact bone metabolism, as there's an increased risk for vitamin D and calcium deficiency related to malabsorption, as well as decreased intake. And then lastly, low serum levels of fat-soluble vitamins and numerous minerals have been found to occur after malabsorptive procedures, but the data is inaccurate as some deficiencies have occurred prior to the surgery. So that's why we do the beforehand focus physical findings and lab values and everything, because we want to see if you already have those deficiencies going on, and that's going to put you at a greater risk of having those deficiencies afterward. So yeah. So next I'm going to talk about the nutritional and medical recommendations following the first 3 months after surgery. So it's very, very strict, I will say that, but obviously for good reason. So it's going to be separated into four different time periods. So the first post-op week one is going to be a full liquid diet. Your goals are going to include 60 to 80 grams of protein per day, 64 ounces of fluid per day, and keep logs recording ounces of fluid and grams of protein consumed. Food should be liquid or semi-liquid, such as water, broth, sugar-free drinks and gelatins, decaf teas and coffees, milk, protein shakes, and protein shakes are going to be required post-op to ensure adequate protein intake. We stress that very much. We stress that before you go into surgery that you already have tried a bunch of protein shakes, you find out which one you like best, and you order a ton of them. I remember that very well, that they were like, hey, have you found your protein shake that you like? Have you figured out what brand you like? They give you a list of brands that are best, and then you get to choose like your flavor and which one you like most. And then they recommend that you buy that. So post-op week 2, 3, and 4 is going to be a pureed diet. So again, your goals are going to be 60 to 80 grams of protein per day. Eat your protein first. 64 ounces of fluid per day. Foods blended or mashed. Avoid spicy foods and foods that range in temperature. And try only one new food at each meal to note tolerance, because you don't know how you're going to react to that food when you start eating it. So foods may include blended lean protein and seafood, cheeses, mashed vegetables, mashed fruits, hot cereals, broths, yogurts, and puddings. Obviously more than that, but just giving you kind of like a little short list. We're going to avoid high-fat meals, nut butters, whole cheeses and milks, raw vegetables, high-fiber fruits and vegetables, pastas, rice, bread, high-fat soups, carbonated vegetables, carbonated beverages, and sweetened drinks. This is going to be one of the times where we do recommend that you are avoiding high fibers. This is because it's going to increase your satiety. So you're going to get fuller faster. And then you're like, oh, I'm not hungry anymore. But then you haven't had hardly anything to eat. And you're not getting any of the nutrients that you need. And you're depriving your body of that. So also, you just had surgery. You don't really need thick fibrous stuff going through your system whenever you're recovering from a surgery. So yeah, that's one of the times that we recommend not high fibrous foods. So post-ops weeks 5, 6, 7, and 8, we're gonna change to a soft diet. Again, your goals, 60 to 80 grams of protein per day. Eat protein foods first, 64 ounces of fluid per day. All foods must be soft or cooked to a soft consistency while chewing well, and then try only one new food per meal to note tolerance. So foods may include ground lean protein, eggs, low fat cheese and milk, tender vegetables, low fiber fruits and vegetables, hot cereal, beans, toast, rice, pasta, reduced fat cream soups, decaf beverages, light yogurts, and puddings. We're going to avoid high fat meals, nut butters, whole milk and cheese, high in fiber fruits and vegetables, soft breads, grains prepared with added butter, and carbonated beverages. And then post-op week 9, we are going to change into a regular diet. So your goals are still going to be 60 to 80 grams of protein per day, 64 ounces of fluid per day. We're going to begin to add raw vegetables. You really want to take your time eating meals and chewing well to increase tolerance, and then keep a record of your tolerances. 3 months after surgery, the patient should be increasing the variety in the diet and attempting to eat foods from all food groups. You don't want to be ignoring certain food groups. So, supplementation after bariatric surgery is required and continued for the rest of a patient's life. Routine supplementation includes multivitamins with iron, not gummies. Don't be consuming gummies. Calcium citrate, 1200 to 1500 milligrams, in divided doses. You need 2 hours apart from iron supplementation. I'm pretty sure usually with the calcium, they will spread it out through 4 doses per day because you can't absorb all that calcium all at once. So I'm pretty sure most cases it's spread out like that, but of course it could be changed to like 3 times per day or kind of whatever works best. Vitamin B12. So you can either do sublingual with 500 micrograms per day. You could do intranasal 500 micrograms per week, or you could do intramuscular, which is going to be 1,000 micrograms per month. We need vitamin D, which is going to be about 3,000 IU. And then we have iron, which is 40 to 65 milligrams needed for menstruating women. And then labs are necessary at each follow-up, and they're going to include a complete blood count, a full lipid panel with 6 to 12 months, B12 every 3 to 6 months for the first year, vitamin D, iron, folic acid every 3 to 6 months for the first year, and then copper, zinc, thiamine are only going to be noted with specific findings. So those are going to be the labs that you need after following a bariatric surgery. So moving on. Let's say that a patient comes in and they're complaining of nausea, shaking, diaphoresis, and diarrhea after eating. The most likely cause is going to be dumping syndrome, and this is what something that we did cover in the upper GI episode. This does happen with patients who go through gastric bypasses and bariatric surgeries. So, dumping syndrome occurs when food and gastric juices from the stomach move to the small intestine in an uncontrolled, abnormally fast manner. So, dumping syndrome is common after any su stomach surgery, such as the Roux-en-Y, any of them, but we are talking about Roux-en-Y here specifically in the paper that I wrote. So, generally, dumping syndrome can be prevented by changing the diet after surgery to include smaller meals and limited sugary foods. Treatment should include the consumption of smaller meals, particularly in someone who has undergone Roux-en-Y and should be consuming smaller meals anyway, because they did just have bariatric surgery. Drinking fluid between meals and not during, that is something that is so important. You absolutely do not need to be drinking fluids during meals, because if you fill up during meals, then you're not going to be hungry for the actual meal, and of course, it's going to lead to a decreased amount of nutrients in your body. Consuming more protein and complex carbs while limiting simple sugars and possibly lactose as well, especially if you're lactose intolerant. And then fiber intake should also be increased, especially in this particular patient, it was a 6-month follow-up visit. So that's whenever we should be increasing your fiber intake. Of course, if you're still in those stages of like the first few weeks, don't increase your fiber intake. But here, fiber can delay the absorption of carbs into the small intestine, so it's going to slow down that dumping syndrome. Just to mention, like I said, this patient is 6-month follow-up, so it's not the same as weeks after. So I'm going to state here, this is an outline of the long-term nutritional and medical management of this patient. It's a little, I mean, it's kind of a repeat of what I mentioned before, but I'm still going to mention it here. Calories should be limited while still consuming balanced meals to prevent nutrient deficiencies and preserve muscle tissue. So, general nutrition guidelines include the following: eat balanced meals with small portions, follow a diet low in calories, fats, and sweets, keep a daily record of food portions and calorie and protein intake, eat slowly and chew small bites thoroughly, do not use straws, drink carbonated beverages, or chew ice. I'm gonna state here, you do not want to drink carbonated beverages because it's all bubbly. It's gonna hurt your stomach. You already don't have enough room to even consume like a full Coke. So it's not worth it. Also, chewing ice, same thing. You're gonna fill up on ice. Straws, I'm pretty sure, is because you could swallow air throughout the straw and it's gonna mess with your stomach. Avoid sugar and containing foods and beverages, and concentrated sweets and fruit juices. Daily caloric intake should not exceed 1,000 to 1,200 calories per day, which blows my mind. We hardly ever recommend that someone consume such a low amount of calories, but in this particular case, when it comes to bariatric surgery, this is one of those times that we do that. Sip 1 cup of fluid between each small meal. Do not drink alcohol. Consume protein-rich foods to preserve muscle tissue. Protein shakes are recommended and may be continued after the recommended time frame. And I did just go over the supplements, so I'm not going to go back through those again with you. Medications may be decreased or stopped after surgery. The medication may be changed to a liquid or chewable form for a period of time as the digestive system is unable to fully digest or absorb the medication, rendering it ineffective. Women should avoid becoming pregnant for 12 to 18 months after surgery to ensure they have adequate nutrition stores and are able to reach their lowest weight. When it comes to that medication, it's talking more specifically about like if you have daily prescribed medication, your doctor may want to change that just to make sure that you're still able to absorb that as needed. I do have here listed an ADIME note, to go through. I'm just gonna say here, this is technically like the end of the episode, but if you are someone who is gonna go into dietetics, you at some point are probably gonna have to write an ADIME note. So I'm gonna go through and read this kind of at how I wrote it and how it was scored well. So this would be a good example of how an ADIME note should be formatted if you are going into dietetics. It is going to be a repeat of a lot of the things I've already said. Some things at the bottom might be a little different. There is some new information in this, so it would be beneficial for you to listen to this if you are going to go into dietetics. So here we go. This is my ADIME note for this particular patient. We're going to go over patient history first. The A stands for assessment. So, patient history, she is a 54-year-old female with a history of extreme obesity. Patient has complaints of increased daytime sleepiness and fatigue, worsening shortness of breath, and edema of both lower extremities. Patient is currently interested in bariatric surgery. Current and past medical history, of obesity, diabetes, sleep apnea, hypertension, dyslipidemia, GERD, and severe degenerative joint disease, and laparoscopic cholecystectomy. Ooh. Family history, obesity, hypertension, diabetes, stroke, and coronary artery disease. Patient social history, non-smoking, no drugs, rare alcohol use, no physical activity, limited adherence to diabetic diet, married with 2 children. Food and nutrient related history. Patient regularly consumes 3 meals per day, occasionally skipping breakfast. Meals are high in fat. Patient consumes snacks between meals as well, consisting of simple sugars. Diet recall. Noted calories consumed above recommended amount. High intake of saturated fats. good intake of dietary fiber, and macronutrient distribution range that is acceptable but not ideal because it was high in fat. Weight history. Current body weight is 294 pounds. Usual body weight is not available. Patient reports inability to lose weight with assistance. Food allergy and intolerances, not available. Pertinent labs. High glucose due to diabetes. High cholesterol due to dyslipidemia, high triglycerides, dyslipidemia, high LDL, dyslipidemia. Her A1C is high due to diabetes, and then low HDL due to dyslipidemia. Pertinent meds. Metformin, 2,000 milligrams per day. Glipizide, 40 milligrams per day. I'm really not going to go through and name all the medications, but list them out and how much they are recommended for. Nutrition focused physical findings. Overall appearance, obese with no acute distress, pitting edema in both ankles, brown pigmentation of both ankles. Side note, I put brown pigmentation of both ankles because if you have brown pigmentation on like your armpits, back of your neck, or ankles, it means that you are probably insulin resistant. Okay, anyway. Anthropometrics. Height, 173 centimeters. Current body weight, 134 kilograms. BMI, 44.7 kilograms per meter squared. Ideal body weight, 63.6 kilograms. Percent ideal body weight, 210%. Adjusted body weight, 81 kilograms. Estimated needs. Mifflin St. George using current body weight with an activity factor of 1.3 gives us 2,587 calories per day. We're going to subtract 500 to 750 calories for obese individuals. Her new range is going to be 1,837 to 2,087 calories per day. Her protein recommendations using 1.5 to 2.0 grams per kilogram of ideal body weight is going to be 95 to 127 grams per day of protein. Now we're going to move on to diagnosis. Here we are going to be using our PES statements. So if you don't know what a PES statement is, you can easily look that up. You're also going to learn it in your medical nutrition therapy classes, so just kind of keep that in mind. I do have three of them, and I use the correct format for all of them. So my PES statements include obesity class 3 related to decreased energy needs as evidenced by a BMI over 44, overconsumption of high-fat foods, estimated excessive intake of 2,700 calories per day, large amounts of sedentary activity, and conditions associated with the diagnosis of obesity such as hypertension, GERD, diabetes, sleep apnea, and dyslipidemia. My next one is limited adherence to nutrition-related recommendations related to food and nutrition-related knowledge deficit concerning how to make nutrition-related changes as evidenced by inability to lose weight, verbalized previous failures to effectively change target behaviors concerning diabetic diet, and lack of improvement in blood glucose levels. My last one is excessive energy intake related to lack of value for behavior changes as evidenced by unwillingness to begin insulin therapy, a BMI of 44.7, intake of energy in excess of estimated or measured energy needs, an intake of high caloric density foods and beverages such as fried foods and saturated fats. So next we're going to move on to the I, and the I stands for, is it inform? Assess, diagnose. I think it's intervention. Sorry. I is intervention. So I have five interventions that I would use for this patient. First, educate patient on calorie counting and portion sizes. Two, educate patient on saturated fats and added sugars, encouraging decreased consumption. Three, educate patient on importance of insulin therapy and maintenance of diabetes, as well as diabetic diet. Four, educate patient on bariatric surgery, the nutrition needs associated with the surgery, and the diet that is to follow a bariatric surgery. And 5, encourage patient to continue consuming high fiber foods and decrease consumption of fried foods. And then the last one is maintenance and evaluation, right? Maintenance. Monitor and evaluation. Ooh, sorry. As you can tell, I haven't done a ton of ADAM notes. So first we're going to monitor her weight. We do want to see a loss of 0.5 to 1 pound per week before bariatric surgery. This is going to be before she actually goes through the bariatric surgery is what this note is for. 2, total energy intake with weight loss. So we do want to see her consuming a range of 1,837 to 2,087 calories per day. 3, monitor patient reports of adherence to diabetic diet and insulin therapy. To do that, we're going to look at patient self-reported adherence. Monitor types of food and meals. We want that to be low fat, low sugar, and smaller portion sizes. We're going to evaluate that through patient diet recall. We're going to monitor her protein intake, and hopefully it is in a range of 95 to 127 grams per day. Lab values, we're going to look at glucose, cholesterol, triglycerides, HDL, LDL, and A1C. We're going to evaluate those as we get them in. We're going to monitor nutrition-focused physical findings, particularly the edema and abnormal skin pigmentation and blood pressure. And we're going to evaluate that upon the next appointment. And then lastly, we're going to follow up about bariatric surgery and adherence to recommended diet following surgery, if she does have the surgery. And we're going to evaluate that by working with other physicians to ensure that she is ready for surgery and referred back after surgery. So that's kind of what an ADAM note is going to look like. Some systems have them kind of built in, so like you can click buttons and just kind of do like a fill-in thing. Other systems don't do that and you write everything out, but that is what an ADAM note would look like prior to surgery. So yeah, I really hope that you guys enjoyed this episode. It's something that I'm super passionate about. All of this information came from my own research I did for a class. This was a case study I did, so just to let you guys know, that's where all that came from. I will be posting all of the references in the show notes, so please feel free to look that up. I do believe that the one of them, I'm going to tell you which one because I want you to go look at it, honestly. Oh, the one that says bariatric surgery procedures from the American Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgeries, if you follow that link, then you will be able to see visuals of what each surgery is going to look like. So I really encourage you to do that if my descriptions weren't enough verbally, which they probably were not. It could really help you. And then totally go follow any of those other links. They're super informational. And I think bariatric surgery is probably going to become more common coming up. So if that's something you're interested in, I really encourage you to follow up with that. I also did one of my other projects for my MNT3 class. I did concerning adolescent bariatric surgery and the risk for anemia. So that was like a really cool topic to cover. There's a lot of research out there about that, and it was really fun to do. So there's a lot out there concerning bariatric surgery, and I just really recommend that if it's something you're interested, please follow it. So that's all I have today, and hopefully I will be coming out with a new episode next week. I do believe I have my orientation for my internship next week, and I'll be getting back Wednesday. So the episode that I put out next week will probably be covering how this past summer semester has gone, things that I learned, and things that I learned during orientation concerning the internship. So it probably won't be a student session. It will be more of an overview of the summer semester for the internship. So if that's something you're interested in, I really encourage you to listen to that because it can really prepare you for whenever you have your internship coming up, just what to expect. Yeah, y'all have a good day.